entitlements in terms of cutting and in terms of also the theft and the bad management of entitlements, tremendous bad management of entitlements. There's tremendous amounts of things and numbers of things you can do.
Yeah, we could put you in jail. For all of your entitlements, you know, the Social Security is not an entitlement. We paid for that.
Skip the rest of that crap. Everybody, when that news piece, that headline, that narrative was running around Monday, Trump is going to cut Social Security and Medicare. And I'm like, there has to be a little bit more to that, because when all the blue checkmark Democrats, legacy media start running a narrative in tandem, chances are there's something more to that. And there are. He just outright didn't say it. He said, possibly, you know, open to the idea of maybe cutting some, reducing some. You know, at some point you do have to make budgets balance, despite what Justin Trudeau thinks. At some point, whoopee. At some point, who's the other one? Cori Bush. You want all these things to pay for themselves. Maybe don't send $200 billion for foreign money laundering to finance proxy wars against Russia. Maybe if you want to not be faced with the hard reality of economics, I mean, we're no economists here. Maybe don't squander hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money to fund foreign proxy wars where a significant portion of that money gets misappropriated. That, and also I wanted to play that highlight because it shows you, yeah, put him in jail. Put him in jail, Trump. What's that? A president enacts policy that we don't like? Well, we'll put you in jail when you're out of office, because that's basically what we're seeing right now. Highlighting the fact that prosecuting a president for crimes, alleged crimes committed while in office, as a matter of constitutional procedure, requires an impeachment and a conviction, failing which you will get activist nincompoops like Whoopi Goldberg saying, you did something we didn't like while you were in office, so we're going to criminally harass you now that you're out of office. All right, good afternoon, everybody. We don't have very much time with Harry McDougald, attorney for Jeff Clark in the Trump RICO case. I'll give like a minute and a half for everybody to tune in. This is going to be amazing. Chat, if I ask too many questions or if I ask like the wrong question, like, did your clients do it? Just someone ping me, text me someone and say, Viva, shut your big mouth. I'm joking. We're going to get into this. This is amazing. You may not know Harry McDougald by name. I think we might recognize him by voice. He is Jeff Clark's attorney. Jeff Clark has been on the channel for a sidebar a long time ago. And, you know, the idea is now that there's a current criminal charges pending. And I think there's gag orders against all of these people. I forget exactly. Probably better to have a discussion with his attorney, not with a current pending, albeit horse crap of a prosecution, criminal accused. So with that said, everybody, we're going to start with Harry. And then however long we go, when we're done with Harry, we're going to come on over to Rumble and talk about some other stuff. I've seen the news, people. I can't keep up with the news. All right, let's do this. Harry, I'm bringing you in. 3, 2, 1. Sir, how goes the battle?
It's very, very busy. Let's put it that way.
You do sound familiar, but I couldn't make out all the faces in the wonderful judicial saga of the Fannie Willis disqualification. You were pleading there, right? You were one of the lawyers pleading?
Yes, I argued at the hearing on March the 1st, I think it was. They kind of run together these days. But yeah, I was up there and I look a little different because I had a haircut and my hair is a little bit unruly like yours. And so it grows out instead of down. So my head shrinks a lot when I get a haircut.
You know, I say like I can tell voices clearly, but I mean, even when we're watching on little screens, it's tough to see. Let me ask you this. I mean, the question right off the bat before we get into some details, the judge came down with a separate ruling today. Or at least dismissal of some of the indictments in the RICO case. That to me is very good indication that he's going to disqualify Fannie and Nathan. What's your prediction for what Scott McAfee's going to do?
Well, I'm not in the prediction business when it's in front of the judge. That's a hazardous undertaking, can have a unfortunate rebound effect. There are a lot of people reading tea leaves that it means one way or the other. I don't really buy that. Judge McAfee is a very orderly guy. And so he had this motion in front of him. It was argued for the first time. The oral argument was December the 1st And there's been a bunch of post-hearing briefings. This one's been on his plate for quite a long time. And he granted it as to 6 counts, a special procedural vehicle for criminal cases in Georgia called a special demurrer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right. A special demurrer. He said it in his decision. It's a lot like what we call a motion for particulars up in Quebec. Motion for specificity in civil matters, demurrer, meaning in criminal law, not even a sufficient allegations to know that against which you need to defend.
Yeah.
So, broad question: how did you get involved in this? Have you ever had any dealings with Fannie Willis in general before this particular hearing?
Never. I supported her. I voted for her in her election last time around because a previous DA needed to go. And so she was the viable opposition candidate and drew support, a lot of support for that reason. But I got involved because I was representing Jeff in connection with subpoenas from the January 6th committee. That work began in late October of 21. That turned into representing him with the DC bar, which began investigating him at the end of 21, and then that matured into charges filed against him in July of 22. And so that case has been ongoing in DC since that time. And so when this case came along, I had familiarity with all the underlying stuff, and I happened to be in Atlanta, so it was convenient.
And where do you practice typically? You're in Atlanta full time.
Yeah, I'm in Atlanta full time. I grew up here, so I'm Atlanta native, and I'm in that court, you know, on a regular basis.
The question is this, people say that Atlanta or Georgia and Fulton County in particular is notoriously corrupt. I've asked a few people who are intimately involved in that area. I mean, is it known to have a problem like this? Like, we're all being exposed to what I think anybody with half a brain deems to be rampant corruption. Is this the way the system works at large, or is this something unique to certain areas in Fulton in particular?
Well, corruption is a pretty strong term. There have been a lot of local government officials sent off to federal prison over the years. I went back and looked, as a matter of fact, and most of them have been City of Atlanta officials. And earlier in my career, I represented a number of whistleblowers against the City of Atlanta. And so I got a pretty good education on how the City of Atlanta government is run by corrupt officials. Fulton County has not had as many convictions, although there have been a few people from both parties. But anybody that lives in the area, if you ask them, well, have you had any extensive dealings with county government, and how did that go for you? Their eyes roll and they shrug. And so I would say it's more administrative incompetence or clown show than it is outright corruption.
I'm not sensitive enough to the fact that you're still a practicing attorney who might not have the liberty of qualifying things the way I would.
So it depends on which particular office you're dealing with. I mean, some of the people that work for county government are absolutely outstanding, and they do their absolute level best under very difficult circumstances. And the judges are, you know, notable in that respect, but they struggle against the constraints that are imposed on them from a funding standpoint by the county commission and all of that. So it's a, and I was actually on the Fulton County Election Board for 8 years. And as I told one of the judges in this case, it was 8 miserable years. And at the end of that, I was very glad to leave. And I began telling people that if you really hate somebody, you should try to get them put onto the Fulton County Election Board.
Now, there's a question in here from Good Logic, who's another lawyer who's been covering this thoroughly as well. And it's one of the questions I was going to get to. We saw after they had their closing arguments, which I'll bring this back up in a second, was an abject disaster from Adam Abate's perspective. At least that's my assessment of his closing arguments. Not to get personal, I think it's what happens when you have a garbage case and you have to raise garbage arguments that are just untenable on their face. But after the closing arguments, there were There were submissions of evidence and briefs which were submitted, and yours was phenomenal. It was a response to Adam Abate's supplemental argument brief. Is it common? Is it common as a standard practice, we see, for there to be multiple applications from both sides to submit evidence briefs after a hearing concludes? Do judges tend to grant those applications?
So that's all kind of ad hoc. There's no specific rule that prohibits it or permits it, and it's according to what the judge will allow. The judge has not said one way or the other whether he will accept any of this proffered post-hearing evidence, although at the end of the hearing he indicated he was not inclined to receive any additional evidence. But if the lawyer feels like it's important and they want the judge to know it, they ought to go ahead and put it up and see if he considers it. And then as far as post-hearing briefs, that's been pretty common in this particular case. And in my experience, state court judges will receive post-hearing briefs. Federal court judges a little more reluctant to do that unless you get specific permission.
I couldn't go through Adam Abate's post-supplemental argument brief because it seemed like it was just rectifying the disaster of his pleading. And it was just the same verbal diarrhea over and over again. Yours was amazing in that it's, you know, keep it simple and straightforward. You have to explain that. Well, actually, before we even get there, proffers. I know what it means, but tell people out there, what does a proffer mean? When the judge is considering it, is it public information? Is it in the court record? Or is it sort of not necessarily under seal? Is it not public information that can be disseminated as though it has already been adduced as evidence?
So a proffer is basically a 50-cent word for offer. And you're saying to the court, if you let me put this in, this is what I'm going to put in. So you describe what the testimony would be and ask them to receive it. And in cases where evidence is excluded, you make a proffer so you can get into the record what that evidence would be so you can argue on appeal that it should have been admitted. So the proffer is just a way for the lawyers to say, hey, we think we've got evidence you ought to consider and here's what it would be.
And so you proffer to a judge. I presume that this is a safeguard for when there's a jury so that the judge would hear it and say, we're not going to present it to a jury. But once you've proffered it to a judge who's like, okay, I've heard what you're going to say. I'm not going to allow it, but I've heard it and it's in my brain. Is that not sort of a fictional, not dichotomy, but a fictional distinction that you've done the damage merely by the proffer?
So with a jury, the old saying is you can't unring the bell. With a judge, presumably due to their metaphysical qualities, they can unring the bell. But yeah, I mean, your point is for a normal person, they would have heard it. But a judge, I think, being disciplined through basically intellectual rigor, could say, okay, well, this is the stack I'm considering, and I don't see anything in here that shows that you ran the red light, and I'm not going to consider this videotape that proves that you did. Therefore, there's no evidence that you ran the red light. So I mean, that would be something a judge could do.
And so the evidence that has been proffered but not yet admitted, cell records, correct? That is not yet accepted evidence in the
court. Right. That's
okay.
Right.
The voicemail from the waiter who said he served Nathan Wade, Terrence Bradley, is that even proffered yet?
That has been proffered, and it's in the form of characterizing what his testimony would be as opposed to his voicemail.
Okay.
So that's been proffered, as has the affidavit of the guy that worked at the winery in Napa Valley.
Yeah, she paid him $400 cash once. There's your evidence that the entire cash reimbursement story pans out. There was something else that was proffered, I thought.
Well, there was the assistant DA, she's got a higher title than assistant DA, but it's a lady who's pretty high up in the Cobb County DA's office.
That she heard she heard Terrence Bradley on the phone with Nathan Wade. No, sorry, on the phone with Fannie Willis.
Correct.
Saying they're coming after us. Don't talk to them.
That's right.
So many questions. It's this case. Is it? Can the argument not be made that that's witness tampering? Have none of the defendants raised that argument yet, or at least gone after some sort of sanction for that potential misconduct?
That argument has been made.
Okay, and there's no separate ethical recourse. Now, we saw recently that the two ethics complaint against Fannie Willis were not dismissed, but they were not going to be heard because the county doesn't have jurisdiction over constitutional officers.
that was their conclusion. So we have multiple bodies that have some sort of jurisdiction to enforce ethics requirements. And one of them is the Fulton County Ethics Board. There's a state ethics board. That's the body that with which you file your campaign disclosure reports. And then for lawyers, of course, there's the state bar.
And so now that Fannie's off the hook on at least one of these, where can someone go ethically to deal with this conduct, set aside sanctioning her in the context of the prosecution?
So those other two bodies, certainly the state bar would have jurisdiction over any breach of the rules of professional conduct. And the state ethics board doesn't have, you know, plenary jurisdiction, but they would have jurisdiction over matters of campaign finance primarily.
Now I'm going to bring this one up. This one's for you, Harry. Just wanted to say your closing was awesome, succinct, passionate, and logical. I felt it. And the walk-off after finishing was totally gangster. And the walk-off, the finish was, this office is a global laughingstock because of their conduct. Harry, it was beautiful.
Well, thank you very much. As far as the walk-off, that wasn't intentionally staged or anything like that. I was finished and I needed to get out of the way to save time for rebuttal. Now, obviously, if the judge had asked me questions, I would have stayed. But
the judicial mic drop. And here's another question, which I was going to get to as well. Recent news that the recording that leaked, you know, the Find Me the Votes, was illegally recorded. Barnes and I, Robert Barnes is the lawyer that he's a mm-hmm. practicing American lawyer. We do this every mm-hmm. Sunday night. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about that from the beginning. That it was settlement discussions and therefore privileged. And I don't know what Georgia state, I'll have to check if it's a one party or, you know, if it's an all party.
Georgia's a one party state. Florida is a two party. Florida is a two party state or state.
It's not illegal because of that, but it's potentially unlawful because it was recording settlement discussions, which are privileged and confidential. People will say you're biased. You're necessarily representing one of the defendants. Tell us, is it not an unlawful recording that was used to initiate this in the first place?
From what has been publicly reported, the call was recorded in Florida. Florida mm-hmm. is a two-party state or an all-party
state. All-party. Mm-hmm. So
and,
it would.
So that leads to certain questions and conclusions, which I will not indulge in here today, but people are talking about that. And, depending on what happens in the future in the case, I expect that will be raised at some point, but I don't know exactly at what stage, in what form, or by whom.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. The people need to be sensitive to the all party consent versus one party consent. Mm-hmm. Set aside the exceptions for doing it. I thought, is there also an angle to it having been either settlement discussions or privileged communications above and beyond two-party consent issues?
I don't know the rule on that. It was set up as a settlement discussion. Lawyers for both sides were on the call. And there were efforts, if you read the transcript, to resolve one or more of issues. I mean, there was a pending election contest in which Trump was suing Raffensperger in Fulton County Superior Court under the Georgia election contest statute. So there was a pending lawsuit. There was therefore a basis for having a settlement discussion. They talked about the issues in the case. They did not come to any kind of an agreement, but they did talk about that. I don't know whether that would preclude using the recording or the discussion in a criminal prosecution. Just as an example, Michael Avenatti was convicted of attempting to extort, I think, Nike.
It was Nike, yep.
Yeah, based on a settlement conference demand that he made at Boies Schiller in New York City. So I don't think it necessarily precludes it. It depends on what's said.
Okay, you're going to get a lot of flattery here, but you're in the right crowd, and it's well-deserved. Tell the smart man how genius his closing was. Fannie and Wade's behavior trying to threaten Wade's wife, both their witness stand behavior, non-ratified perjury, is the conflict of interest. The threatening of Jocelyn Wade's wife. I forget the details, and if you know the details.
I do.
So she basically intimated or said outright, This is interference with an ongoing criminal prosecution. Did she say it in legal pleadings or in court proceedings? And she was saying it in response to what? Having been subpoenaed to testify?
Right. So the procedural setup for that is that Nathan Wade's wife served a subpoena on Fannie Willis to testify at a hearing for what's called temporary support, which is you need to support me while this divorce is pending, which is provided for by Georgia law. So District Attorney Willis engages private counsel, files a motion for protective order with respect to that subpoena, which was to bring her to court to testify at a hearing. And in that motion for protective order, invoked something that in the U.S. is called the Apex Doctrine, which is if you're the head of a big organization, you can't be made to sit for a deposition or testify in a hearing unless the party seeking your testimony meets certain thresholds, which is they can't get the information from anybody else. And that's to protect big shots from having to spend time. I mean, you can argue about whether that's a good rule, but that's the statute now in Georgia. So she invoked that statute, said, I'm the DA. I'm the DA. You can't bring me in here. And also said that the subpoena is intended to harass and annoy the DA and interfere and obstruct an ongoing criminal prosecution, which she referred to in the case in her motion as the election prosecution. So she invoked her status as DA. She accused the wife of obstructing and interfering with criminal prosecution. And that's just unmistakable what that implies. I mean, it's just absolutely unmistakable. So that really struck me as
grotesque. I mean, it's legally something grotesque.
Something that needed to be mentioned in this case.
Okay. Now, today's hearing that dismisses six of the 41 indictments or the charges. From what I understand, I haven't cross-compared it. Does it impact Jeffrey, or does it impact Jeff, your client?
It does not. It does not. Jeff is not. So there are six counts that were dismissed. He's not a defendant on any of those counts.
All right. And in that particular ruling, I'm going to get back to it later on with you, not with you on air. It dismissed six of the indictments, but did not dismiss six of the overt acts. I'm a Quebec or was a Quebec lawyer, civil, and I never really did criminal law. That it sounded like they were asking that allegations of fact be struck from the indictment. How does that work? Yeah.
So the six counts of the indictment have corresponding overt acts that are alleged as a part of the RICO count, which is count one. So RICO count one is based on, 140 or 161 overt acts. And then the rest of the counts against various defendants, it kind of tic-tac-toe through the other defendants. They have separate counts, but it's generally referring to the same conduct. Okay. So what the order is saying is that, well, they can't survive as a freestanding count of a criminal indictment under the special demurrer standard, but they can stand as overt acts in a RICO conspiracy. And that's because the pleading standard for an overt act in a RICO conspiracy charge is much lower than it is for an independent freestanding count, criminal count.
Okay, it's interesting. I was just looking at the overt act 156, where Trump is alleged to have said, find whatever the legal process is, or whatever the I think it's whatever the legal process was. I'll pull it up afterwards. And I was like, why would they even want to have that allegation struck? To me, I'd want to have that in there to show the RICO criminality is saying, find me the legal remedy to do this.
I'm sure they'll argue that at trial. I mean, ever since the call came out of the news, my view of it has been, okay, the Secretary of State is the chief enforcement officer for election law in Georgia. It's his job to investigate frauds and irregularities in elections. So think of him as the election police. Donald Trump is a candidate who thinks the election was subject to fraud or irregularity. So he calls the election police and says, hey, I think I got jobbed and I want you to look at A, B, C, and D. I don't think that's a felony.
It's not just that. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are thoroughly convinced chicanery was afoot and Kemp did nothing to look into it, because you're understanding Kemp doesn't like Trump any more than some of the Democrats like Trump?
Well, they've had some harsh words. Let's put it that way.
I feel I get to ask all these nitty-gritty questions. Like, it's like I feel it feels like gossip, but I'm asking. The divorce case settled overnight, right? That case is done, and Jocelyn
in part,
and Nathan.
In part, what they settled was the temporary support part of it, which obviated the need for the hearing that was set for I think January the 28th or something like that, January the 31st, somewhere back in there. So they didn't have to have the hearing, and that was, you know, that was a smart thing for Mr. Way to have done. And he's got a very good lawyer up in Marietta representing him on that matter.
Not Terrence Bradley. Bada bing, bada boom.
His name is Scott Kimbrough, and he's a very good lawyer.
I have a sneaking suspicion Jocelyn Wade's stock went up substantially after the news broke, which facilitated a settlement, or at least a temporary one. So they have to turn that temporary order into a permanent one for Alamo.
So the temporary order is designed to support the dependent spouse during the pendency of the divorce. And so it provides for monthly support payments and maybe payment of attorney's fees and things of that nature until they either go to trial or reach a final settlement.
Did you watch Ashley Merchant's testimony before the Senate investigation?
I was not able to take it in because I was too busy working on Jeff's case.
She had mentioned something like, this is where, you know, set aside all the corruption and the lack of ethics and the immorality. It's an undisputed fact that Nathan Wade was concealing assets from Jocelyn Wade, correct?
It certainly appears that way from the divorce file.
Ashley, and you'll tell me if you know anything about this, but she testified about the IOLTA, the interest. What is the IOLTA? Interest only attorney accounts?
Yeah, it's interest on lawyers' trust accounts is what that stands for.
Okay, now, and do you have any knowledge of this that allegedly Nathan Wade was using it to park funds in so that he could, you know, not release, but take those funds out later at tax advantageous rates?
Not firsthand. I've not studied the documents on that, but I'm aware of that.
All right. Has there been any meaningful political blowback from all of this being exposed in Fulton County, in Georgia, in general?
Well, I'm no expert on that, but you got to believe that it has had some political impact, but just because of the intensity of the news coverage. I mean, the case has got everything that news people want in a story. It's got every hot button issue in America right now practically is present in this case right now. So it's catnip for reporters.
Scott McAfee's facing a challenger, what has been described as a Jesse Jackson, a political activist with the Rainbow Push Fund, or I don't know what that is.
Rainbow Push Coalition is what they're called.
What do you know what that is?
That was a activist organization that Jesse Jackson founded probably back in the 80s. Maybe even before that. And, you know, he's no longer active in that. And so folks like this fella, Mr. Patillo, who I don't know anything about him, are carrying on with that type of work.
Without predicting the judgment, do you have any predictions on the election now that Scott McAfee is facing a contender?
No idea.
All right. And let me see. Another question. So now we're awaiting judgment one way or the other. This is a question everybody's asking. If the judge is either going to do one of, I guess, three things, either nothing, disqualification, or disqualification and dismissal of indictment. Those are the three options, and any variation of the three.
Yeah. So Georgia, we have the rule now that if the DA is disqualified, then the entire office is disqualified, because the authority of any subordinate of the DA flows through the DA. So if she's out, they're out. So that's how that would work. And then dismissal is a remedy that's provided in some of the older cases if the DA has a personal interest at the time of indictment.
All right. My theory has been, or at least my understanding is, if they DQ both it doesn't matter if they disqualify one and not the other. If they disqualify both of them but do not dismiss the charges, they've got to get another DA's office in. Now that there's six less charges, they might even be saying this whole thing is deficient. The real prospect is that if the office is disqualified, they've got to find some other DA who's willing to continue the prosecution here.
That's right. So there's a couple of things there. One is that there's a body created by statute called the Prosecuting Attorneys Council of Georgia. And by statute, if a DA's office is disqualified, it goes to the Prosecuting Attorneys Council of Georgia to figure out what to do with the case. And they'll either assign one or more of their lawyers to the case, or they will try to engage another DA's office to prosecute the case. So back in the summer of 22, when the special purpose grand jury was up and running, the DA's office was disqualified with respect to one particular target, who's the current lieutenant governor named Burt Jones. And that was based on a political conflict because the DA Willis, held a fundraiser for a Democrat candidate for lieutenant governor. So therefore, directly contrary to the political interests of Burt Jones. So a different judge, Judge McBurney, said, okay, you're out. You're out of this case as to Burt Jones. You can't investigate him. You can't prosecute him. You can't indict him. You're out. So that case has gone over to the Prosecuting Attorneys Council. And in July, it will be 2 years since that happened.
Is there, what's
the... And there has been nothing from that office pertaining to Burt Jones since then.
Is there not an automatic stay just by virtue of passage of time? What's that delay in the states?
I don't actually know what happens to statutes of limitations during this period of disqualification. I think that's a pretty good question, but I don't know the answer to it. So I can only give you tummy rumbles about what that ought to be.
All right. And we got here. Wade lied on his financials. Is that a crime? Well, a broader question. Who would bring charges against Fannie Willis or Nathan Wade? I mean, she's the DA. It's like almost like who's going to, what was it from The Simpsons? Who's going to police the police? And, you know, Homer Simpson says the Coast Guard. Who could conceivably charge the DA? And what would it take for something like that to happen?
So that's a pretty good question. So let's just kind of take them stepwise. If a prosecutor believes that there was false swearing, you know, lying under oath, or false writing in the divorce case, the venue for that would be Cobb County, Georgia. That would be the Cobb County DA. If there were crimes committed in Fulton, the first venue would be the Fulton County DA's office. They're obviously conflicted. They can't prosecute themselves. So that would go to the Prosecuting Attorney's Council. But it'd be extremely rare for a DA to be indicted in Georgia. That's almost never happens. Now, anything is possible. And then there's always the federal government, if there's a jurisdictional hook for federal jurisdiction. But, you know, the chances of the Joe Biden Justice Department indicting Fannie Willis are extremely remote.
I mean, maybe they'll invite them over for another meeting at the vice president's residence.
Yeah. Maybe indict themselves.
And the IRS, I mean, they're looking for money. Is there any whispering as to whether or not the IRS has perked their ears up, seeing what's going on?
I have not heard a single thing about that, and nor would I. I mean, I've got no pipelines into those guys. I know nothing about that.
There's no IRS tip line that people can say, "Hey, I think tax fraud may have occurred here."
You know, the smoke signals, the drum signals from IRS, they don't reach my office.
I can't ask you what's next for Jeff, but what's next in the file? You're waiting on this decision.
We have briefing due. I mean, we filed a bunch of motions as well. Trying to kick the case out altogether, and you know, then separate motions to kick out different bits and pieces of it, and those will be progressing through the litigation process. We have reply briefs that we need to work on, and then we in D.C. we are set for trial on the Barr case beginning March 26th. So that's coming right up. So that's one reason I'm so busy.
I know. Well, and I will not keep you a minute longer.
That's quite right.
Promise 30 minutes. So you got to go to DC for hypothetically that trial goes down. How long do you have to be in DC for?
Well, until it's finished, we think the case will take 12 to 14 days. But you know, it's very hard to predict how long trials will take.
Incredible. All right. I will not keep you longer than this. I want to see if I missed anything. On a program, McAfee said he had the outline of his ruling prepared before he knew there was a challenger to his seat. Whether or not we believe that, when I heard that Scott McAfee was actually doing interviews, I thought that was, I won't say inappropriate. I just thought it was weird that any judge would be giving any public interviews. I would have reached out if I had known that. Is that unheard of?
No. Judge McBurney, who had the special purpose grand jury supervision, he gave some interviews. But typically, you don't see judges giving interviews. But Judge McAfee is, you know, he's a candidate for public office, so he's allowed to talk to the media. And he stays away from anything that would be remotely improper. I mean, he's a very careful guy, as I'm sure you've noticed. Very, very... decorum seems to be a preeminent concern for him in the courtroom, and I'm sure that carries through with everything that he does.
He reminds me of my second oldest brother, so I like him even though I don't.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, I won't share a picture of my old brother unless he wants me to. But demeanor wise, intellectually, I've had him pegged for being a very strict, sincere yeah. person.
People yeah, if you read the orders, that's very clear. So, you know, before I get off, I would be remiss if I did not invite your viewers who are so inclined to look up Jeff Clark's Give, Send, Go page. And if they're able to make a donation, it's I'm going on this case, on his cases flat out all the time. And he needs help.
I'm gonna share it right now. Actually, I've shared it. Give, Send, Go, Jeffrey Clark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll get this right here.
Thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. This I'll show it, and you'll confirm that it's not a knockoff because yeah.
Got to keep the lights. Got to keep the lights on here.
This is it, Jeff Clark.
Yes, that's it. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. I'm gonna share this with everybody, and we're gonna see undoubtedly a bit of an uptick right now. Hold on, I'm gonna put it here. Link. And are you on social media?
I am on Twitter at Harry MacD.
Okay. If I'm not already, I'm not following you. Of course I'm following you. Keep up the amazing work. Thank you very much for the time.
Well, your commentary about the case where I've been able to take it in has been very astute. And your legal background really shows in your analysis. And I think people like yourself who are lawyers who offer commentary on cases that the public is interested in are really doing a public service of helping people understand what's going on, because it gets a little convoluted at times.
It gets convoluted, and most people wouldn't believe it if someone just, you know, someone said this is what happened. If they hadn't seen it or they weren't able to see it with their own eyes, nobody would believe the level of corruption yeah. and immorality yeah. in this particular case.
Well, I mean, let me just offer one last thing. I mean, in the case of Jeff Clark, all of this relates to a draft letter that was within the Justice Department and the president that never left the building. Confidential letter. It was not approved. It was never sent. And so imagine if you're a lawyer and you draft a document that your team or your client decides not to send, and then you find yourself charged with two felonies and the Bar Association trying to disbar you. That's where Jeff Clark is.
It's atrocious, and it's particularly ironic given Terrence Bradley arguing solicitor-client privilege while they've indicted someone for what was solicitor-client advice.
Yeah, I mean, it's executive privilege, law enforcement privilege, deliberative process privilege, attorney-client privilege. And, you know, once they decided the letter wasn't going to go, that was the end of it.
You'll have a very good afternoon. McDougald, most impactful close of the entire proceedings. It's been a group effort, but yeah.
From their lips to Judge McAfee's ears.
The bar complaint against Jeff, that was, he's successfully contested that, correct? That one is done, or is that still ongoing?
Oh no, that's what's going to trial March 26th.
Oh, I'm an idiot. I'm mixing it up. He just had a success.
We did. So there was a subpoena for documents in the Barr case, and we challenged this. We objected to the subpoena based on the Fifth Amendment, and the highest court in the District of Columbia government system which is called the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, ruled in our favor on that on the 26th of February, which was the first business day after argument. My co-counsel argued that case to the D.C. Court of Appeals. Charles Burnham did an absolutely sensational job, and they ruled in our favor on that the next business day.
Okay, I got confused. I just got confused. Amazing.
But unfortunately, that did not dispose of the whole case.
Okay. All right. Well, if you have time afterwards, you'll please come back and we'll do the post-mortem.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day. And I'll make sure to blast a link around.
Okay. Thanks. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's amazing. Holy crab apples. There were a few in there that I didn't want to ask him because I knew that he would not answer or that we had already touched on. Hold on. Nathan Wade should be disbarred for hiding his money, earnings, and escrow accounts. I don't think there's going to be many people who would disagree with that. Ashley mentioned a lawsuit in the hearing that was pending. What is that lawsuit for? Cripe. I'll find out afterwards. This was the question. David, please ask Harry if he's encouraged about the disqualification ruling based upon McAfee not wanting to hear the other stuff he in and argued. Harry was, sure to mention that he doesn't want to He doesn't want to make predictions. My prediction is, yeah, it means the judge knows where he's going. My prediction is, given the judge's ruling today, it's a small victory for the defendants. They dismissed 6 of the 41 indictments. He's setting up the groundwork. He's not on board with how this was drafted, let alone how it was conducted after it was drafted.